Good afternoon. We'll call a meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. First item that we have is approval of the minutes for February 26th. Representative Hortman will move those minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. First up, we've got, we don't have an author for this bill. Representative Winkler, I understand, is chairing his own meeting or gathering. House File 2162. The Representative Lilly will move House File 2162 be recommended to pass. Not be recommended to pass. Laid over. I'm getting so carried away already. Yeah, as long as you can get her done, right?
We'll disagree.
We'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Mayor, Your Honor, thank you for joining us this afternoon. My understanding is that you have a city council meeting or a council gathering in about 45 minutes or so. So thank you for joining us.
Pretty close. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Members of the committee, I'm Shep Harris, Mayor of Golden Valley. To my left, your right, is City Council Member Andy Snope, and with me as well, I have the Director of Golf Operations and Manager of Golf Operations, Ben Ditch, and I also have Rick Berno, the Director of our Parks and Recreation Department. I want to thank you for your time. I also want to thank the Majority Leader for letting us cut in quickly, because yes, we do have our City Council meeting this evening, so we will be short. Of course, I want to thank Representative Winkler, who couldn't be here this evening. Members, House File 2162 is a pretty... I guess you'd say it's becoming more of a standard bill. In this case, it allows the City of Golden Valley to issue an on-sale license to a city-owned golf course. Members, for those who don't know, Golden Valley, it's a wonderful place to live, to play, to work. It's a first-ring suburb in the West Metro area, about 20,000 in population during the weekends and night times. But during the daytime, it actually grows a little bit larger. We're home to places like General Mills, Honeywell, Tenet, and of course the international headquarters of Buffalo Wild Wings. So there's a lot going on in Golden Valley, and yes, we love that place too. And for that reason, our premier park is Brookview Park, which includes our golf course. And unfortunately, at this point in time, we are only allowed by state law to offer 3.2 beer. The options are becoming very challenging in terms of the market. To stay viable in the market, we are coming forward and asking for your authorization to be able to sell, to do an on-sale liquor license. You may have heard, or you may not have heard, we want to become the Brits Pub of the West Metro. We are going to be opening up, I think, how many courses?
Eight
rinks of lawn bowling starting in August. And there's nothing like having a lawn bowling ball in one hand and a pint in the other. And one goes with the other, and we would appreciate the opportunity to make that happen with your support. And members, I'll stand for any questions or defer to our staff and council members.
And thank you all, by the way, for joining us this afternoon. Are there questions for members?
Field trip.
Other than request for a field trip, that's a good sign. There don't appear to be any questions or concerns being raised. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for taking the time this afternoon for us. With that, House File 2162 is laid over for potential inclusion in the House Liquor Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Chair members.
Thank you. Thank you. Next up is House File 2180. The Chair moves House File 2180 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Murphy, thank you for your patience in allowing us to take an item first. It's very nice of you. I am also going to ask that you make a couple minutes of comments. I've got a former chair of this committee who has to leave at about 4:15 to get to another engagement, who I believe authored a previous version of this bill and would like to say a few words as well. But obviously, first words go to you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm grateful to be before the Commerce Committee again to talk with you about House File 2180. And it is the Health Insurance and Transparent Accountability Act. This is a proposal that uses competitive bidding and transparency to try to drive down costs for health insurance for school employees and school districts and property taxpayers. And it is the result of a lot of work by teachers and the folks at Education Minnesota realizing that the proposal that they have been working on for the last decade to achieve that same goal has had trouble in the legislature. And I am really delighted to carry this piece of legislation because I think it represents a novel approach, another way to try and achieve the same goal using competition and transparency. I want to tell you that it is not a highly controversial bill, but it is a complicated bill, and there are many stakeholders. And we are in the thick of discussions with a number of those stakeholders. The bill was heard last week in education policy. We're being heard today. We have a number of stops to go, but we've had a number of and very fruitful conversations with the health plans. We've met with the service co-ops. We're meeting with the school districts shortly, the charters, et cetera. And so as we're moving through the committees, we're going to be working on the issues of jurisdiction, and I want to let you know that while we have not reached a final conclusion with the health plans, we have made a lot of progress. They will tell you that themselves when they are able to testify. But I want to say this. We have always been an innovator in healthcare and a leader in healthcare, and I think this approach in this piece of legislation, which Mr. Pender can walk us through if you'd like, will serve to move forward and find a path for more affordable health care for school district employees, for school districts, for property taxpayers. And with that, I welcome your questions and the discussion. Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I don't believe that we need a walkthrough. Most members come fully prepared. We've all read every line of every bill that's before us this afternoon. But we do like having Representative Pender, who also is also called Mr. Pender occasionally. But with that, I know Representative Davids needs to leave shortly and wanted to share a few words with us about the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your consideration. I won't go away mad. I'll just go away. I have a prior engagement in the town of Revere, Minnesota. Have you ever been there?
I'm going to.
It's not too far from Lamberton. So
I've heard it's almost as nice as Golden Valley.
I've got a prior commitment there that I want to that I need to keep, but there's a lot of history on this bill, and I hate to say that I carried it for 7 years and never got it passed, because I guess that just shows that I didn't do very well. But the bill that I carried was much more extensive than this. We actually set up a statewide health pool for educators and school employees. It's one that I worked on, put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in, but I'm either already on this bill or I will be soon. House File 2180. I support what we're trying to do here, and I may be a minority in the minority. But that being said, if you look at what's going on in healthcare for our educators, we need to do whatever we can to try and bring a more affordable type plan there, and I think this bill gets us going in the right direction. And so I hope that this passes. If there's not enough votes on the other side, just table it. I'll be back later, and we'll get her passed. So just do what you got to do, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Majority Leader Murphy, for your efforts on this, and I'll be glad to help you out any way I can on this one.
Thanks, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Murphy, thank you for your graciousness in stepping out of the normal order of things. I see you're accompanied by a friend to testify in favor of the bill, I assume. Sir, if you'll just identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Brandon Redke. I'm the Director of Public Affairs at Education Minnesota. I will keep my comments brief. As Chairman said, all you guys are well prepared at every committee hearing. So Education Minnesota is always looking for ways to make health care coverage for educators more affordable, fair, and predictable. As Representative Davids mentioned, we've worked on a variety of proposals over the last decade, and I want to talk to you just a few minutes about our new proposal that we're calling the Health Insurance Transparency and Accountability Bill. What we really are trying to do is bring some reforms to the way that the bidding and purchasing of health care is done within school districts, focusing on creating competition and increasing the number of bids that school districts receive from insurance providers, enacting good government reforms, and protecting members' premium dollars. So we really try to do a few things. The first is to see competitive bidding in two ways. First, to do so by requiring school districts to request at least three different bids for health insurance, with requiring one of those three requests to go to the Public Insurance Employment Program, PEEP, and when PEEP will be required to submit bids to all RFPs. Second, the bill also requires that health insurance bids be put on the same timeline, be sealed until the bids are open, and be based on the actual claims data. This will ensure that providers are putting their best foot forward from the start and basing bid on usage data. Secondly, we ask for some good government reforms that, in order to even prevent even the appearance of any conflict of interest, the bill would prohibit school board members and administrators from receiving gifts from people or organizations seeking to do business with the district. And we expand the open meeting law to committees or task force that the service co-ops have related to health insurance. And finally, the bill protects insurance premium dollars by requiring premium surpluses that are returned to districts to be negotiated over or used to offset future premium costs. The bill is different from other proposals that we've had in the past in a couple significant ways. The first, it does not create a single statewide school pool for school employees. And second, it does not force any individual school district to choose an individual a specific provider. Our goal in the bill is simple. First, we want to make districts to get multiple bids. We want a sealed bidding process to open up the process and bring the best bids forward. And we want to let districts make the best choices for themselves. As Majority Leader Murphy mentioned, we have met with representatives from the administrators, school boards, service co-ops, and health plans. Through these discussions, we have found out more about, from the health plan, some of the new requirements under ACA for bidding. This has led to some very fruitful discussions, and we have agreed to some changes and continue to talk about other changes that we could all agree to. We've gone through multiple redrafts of the bill, author amendments, and they reflect our willingness to work to get a bill that is hopefully workable for all parties involved. We are committed to continue our discussions with other parties and the authors to try and seek language that hopefully meets everyone's concern. With that, I'll just say I urge you to pass the bill out of committee today, and I thank you for your time and stand for any questions.
And thank you, Mr. Ratke. And I think what we're going to do is hold off on questions until we've taken all the testimony. So if you can, please stick around.
Sure.
Thank you. Next up is Ms. Racine. I'm sorry. I'm just reading them off the list here. I don't make the list, but I've got Joyce Racine, Jennifer Schaubach, Gretchen Garcia, and a few others. So, plus, Ms. Racine happens to be from my school district, so just saying.
And he looks very stunning in a Dr. Seuss hat, by the way.
Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
It was Dr. Seuss readathon day yesterday, and I showed up, did my part, and got a defective hat that I could not keep. So in any event, Mr. Seaton, welcome to the committee.
Very nice to be here. I just want to tell you a bit about our health care in Invergrove Heights. We've had escalating health care premium rates through the years, through the 90s and beyond. They're getting, have gotten, as you know, out of control, and through the Transparency Act, we want to make everything out in the open so that we get the best prices the first time. Looking at our specific information, in 2006, 2007, we were looking between a 10 and 13% increase in premium only. And that was even when we were adding to or having to put more money out of pocket with higher copays. So we're all aware through health care too that the costs keep going up. But magically, when we were given or had to get all three bids, which we've always done, and one of them was our PEEP bid, our premium rate went down to 9%. Oh, sorry, from 9%, sorry, down to 0% increase, 0% the second year, 2.5%. 0%, and for next year, we have a cap of 4.75%. And that isn't under the good graces of our insurance provider, but because we have to go out and get competitive bids, we are being provided with the best possible price that they can provide for us. And the bill just asks everybody to do the same thing. Have open, give the sealed bid, so it is your best shot the very first time, without having to grovel back and say, well, maybe we could have done it a little bit better. We did not decide to go with our public employee insurance plan. We stayed with our own provider because, as you know, changing healthcare providers is scary, worrisome, and it becomes a big headache. Again, we just want everything to be above board. No paybacks. No incentives for anybody working with the business. You guys have that in the legislature. We have that as classroom teachers, and we just want to put that same policy to all the levels in between, just to, maybe there wasn't a true conflict of interest, but not even have the looks of a conflict of interest in our plans. As we were talking, it seems like the Common Sense Act, Common Sense Bill. Nobody's trying to get away with anything. We just want everything to be the best it can be with the reality of the dollars and the expenses of insurance. That wraps
it up. Very good. All right. Mr. Thank you very much.
And you guys weren't like throwing spitballs or anything.
Well, not yet.
I'm very impressed.
As the hearing goes on and it gets a little later, you. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gretchen Garcia, and I come from Representative Hoppe's home district of Eastern Carver County Schools, and am the president of the Teachers Association there, representing over 700 folks in that local. Information is key. We all know that as educators, as legislators, you act on information, and that's at the heart of this bill. The multiple bids provides our districts more information and in a transparent way so that we can make the best value decision. In our home district, teachers who are looking to pay for family coverage are paying between $8,000 and $12,000 annually on a teacher's salary toward family coverage. That's not, that's after the benefit has been paid. The costs are astronomical, and I just implore you to support this so that we can take these measures to lower costs. Multiple bids really does, as Joyce said, help to level the playing field and keep everybody honest and above board. We don't know what we don't know, and the multiple bid process simply provides the information on a regular basis to districts. Our district went to self-funding this past year, but even in our situation, we continue have to look for providers in as their contracts expire, and the bidding process is very important even in a self-funded district. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Also on the list that we've got signed up, Mr. Peterson, Ms. Sink, Mr. Mons, and Mr. Walseth. And I had Ms. Schaubuck, but I didn't see her come up when we... Okay, thank you. And it doesn't really matter what order. Whoever wants to kick off, just identify yourself for the record and proceed. Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Julie Sink. I'm the Director of Business Affairs for Prior Lake Savage Area Schools. About 4 years ago, Prior Lake Savage Area Schools moved from a fully insured plan to a self-insured health insurance program. In a self-insured model, just so that you understand, our premiums go into a special fund in our district. They no longer go to one of the big providers. That money stays in a special fund in our district. And then what the district does is they contract with a third-party administrator to process our claims. And then we also pay a small premium for what we call stop-loss insurance, or what you can think of as a reinsurance. So any claim that's over $200,000, that premium, that other company would pay any claim that's over that $200,000. So what we do not bid a fully insured plan. We bid those self-insured portions. At the end of the year, after all of our claims are made and paid, any remaining dollars stay in that fund. And then if we happen to have a bad year, then we don't see those rates go up higher because we have those funds on hand to help offset those increases. In the past 4 years, our district has seen an increase of just over 1.5% a year. And so we have this bill, however, doesn't allow for districts to bid the self-insurance model. We have to bid PEEP, which doesn't have that model of self-insured. And so that we see that as a problem. And that is one of our biggest concerns, is that PEEP cannot meet the needs of those self-insured districts. There is a cost to districts to create these RFPs and write the specs. We would need to hire consultants to do that every other year. And so that is a cost to our districts that we see as an unfunded mandate. And so we would like to see any appropriation that may be going to PEEP to be coming back to the districts to help offset those costs.
My name is Matt Mons. I'm the HR director for the Prior Lake Savage Area School District. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak briefly. I wanted to just address the difference in the RFP process, or the sealed bid process that's being discussed, between being a fully insured or a self-insured school district. And under a fully insured model, you would request to carriers to make a bid. You'd receive those bids, and they'd come back, and your premium rate increases. However, for a self-insured district, we simply pay out the claims that we incur. It's really not based on guessing the same way. And for us, what we're really interested in isn't what Blue Cross or PEEP would want to tell us they can do with our premiums. What we're really interested in is when you look at our cost drivers, the physicians that our employees see, the prescriptions that they utilize, we really want to know what kind of discounts have they negotiated with those clinics, those physicians, those RX companies, so that we can get the most bang for our buck. And so when we go out for a self-insured bid, we're not wondering whether we're going to get premium rate increases of 5% or 10%. We're concerned, are we going to be able to get the deepest discounts with this carrier? And so that's a very different product that we're trying to go out for, to bid for at that point. And that's the concern. That's one of the concerns that we have, is how do you measure those two products that you're receiving a bid from, one of which we're trying to receive discount information on providers. Another one, under a fully insured model, we're seeing an estimate for a percentage increase on our insurance premiums. So that's a concern that we have, is how do you navigate the process in a sealed bid format of selecting the best option. Another reason that districts go self-insured is to avoid the situation where you have carriers buying your business. And as we've heard previously through previous witnesses, you'll see during the bid process that you'll get a number of bids. There's competition there, but at the same time, there's nothing to prevent an individual carrier from buying your business in the short term to attract you as a customer. And as I said at the beginning of my testimony, we simply pay our claims. So going self-insured eliminates that potential to have somebody buy your business in the short term and then raise the rates down the line. The last point that I'd like to make is there are some timelines that talk about a 150-day window where you would need to go out to bid, and then also a 90-day window that you would have from the time you receive bids to electing a carrier. For a self-insured district, we have the additional necessity of also bidding out stop loss, which does throw in an additional wrench and makes it very difficult to operate under those stricter timelines. So if there was a way to look at changing some of the language around those timelines to be a little bit more flexible, that would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Tom Peterstone. I'm the Human Resources Director for the Rosemont App Valley Eagan School District. We have over 27,000 students and provide a self-insured health plan for over 2,700 employees. I have a few concerns regarding the bill before you. The discussion thus far has been that the bill would apply only to health insurance. However, in Section 7, it defines group insurance in those chapters 61A, 62A, 62C, and 62D, and 43A, 316, as those refer to other types of coverage, life insurance and dental insurance specifically. And I think if that's what we intended for this, we should probably be clear about that so we know exactly which insurances this impacts, because I'm not sure that PEEP can provide proposals on those lines of coverage. It also appears that this bill only pertains to school districts, and if this is a good practice for school districts, why wouldn't it make sense to include cities and counties on this? I believe we also need to be very clear about what we mean by in the way of sealed bids. To me, this could imply that we have to take the lowest bid. If we intended to be able to further negotiate with carriers after the bid openings, I would strongly suggest we consider adding some language to allow that. Otherwise, we could be subject to challenges from carriers that gave us the lowest bid if the insurance committee and the district don't move forward with that lowest bid. So I think it's important to be really clear about that so we don't have challenges down the road. Self-funded plan plans request proposals on administrative misadministration of claims, reinsurance, or stop loss. And it really doesn't make any sense for us to go through the time and expense of requesting a fully insured proposal from PEEP or anyone else. And I think it'd be really helpful if the bill were clear on what it intends there for us. As far as the deadlines, Mr. Mons covered that. And we just need enough time when we get the proposals back to be able to negotiate further with carriers, communicate to employees, prepare documents for and conduct our open enrollment period, and then enact employee changes to their health coverage before the end of the plan year. And we really have to do that before school's out, or we'd lose a large share of our employees before that happens. So we have to conduct that before school's out. So we do need some flexibility with the deadlines on that. Being a self-funded plan, I really don't see anything in this bill that would benefit our district in our insurance situation. We have managed it well. We've had great success. We've had low premium increases. And we're just concerned that this could negatively impact our future insurance program. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'll stand for any questions.
Well, thank you. We appreciate your taking the time and the constructive suggestions that you've had. As far as others on the list, I've got Mr. Walseth. I've got Ms. Commit. Mr. Walseth, welcome back. Ms. Racine, welcome back.
Thank you. I didn't want to, like, bribe anybody by leaving my
Mr. Chairman and members, Sam Walseth, representing 8 service cooperatives who insure about 30% of the school employees in the state of Minnesota. I just want to say we want to thank the author and the advocates for their approach this year. I asked you last year to preserve a competitive bidding process, a competitive bidding market for school employee insurance, and to date that still exists, although there's other legislation still pending. This is a bill. We're working with the author and the advocates to try and clean up some of the language, to make this a little more workable for people involved. And all I want to do today is put a few things on the record that we're working with the author on. In Section 5, there's an issue about school district school employee compensation prohibition. I think I understand what they're getting at with that provision, but we want to make sure that language doesn't go so far as to prevent wellness incentives, such as a health plan paying for gym memberships or other health risk assessments that are new functions that are taking place in group insurance policies. And we flagged that with the author and the advocates. They're taking a look at that as well, but I think that's something important to consider there in Section 5. As it relates to Section 8 or Section 10, the new Subdivision 8 in the group purchasing statute, we'd like to see some clarity on lines 721 to 723, just to make sure that PEEP is not coming in after the 90-day sealed bid process and able to put in bids after the fact. And that's been noted with the author and advocates as well, working on that provision too. And then it was mentioned in previous testimony just before me, we want to clarify that there is some room to negotiate after the bids are open. Sealed bids are open so that districts and employee groups can continue those negotiations with health plans to make sure they are getting the plan that they want and not just simply the one that costs the cheapest. That may not actually be what the employees want. And just for the record, too, Mr. Chair, members, school districts have to abide by an aggregate value of benefits requirement, so they can't necessarily just take the lowest cost bid. So we want to make sure that that provision there doesn't trip up what has been a longstanding employee protection, actually. And then, Mr. Chair, we do think that PEEP should abide by this new bidding statute as well. There is an exemption in the PEEP statute 43A.316 subdivision 10 that does exempt PEEP from these bid requirements. That's old language that's been on the books for a long time. I don't know if it's intentional necessarily, but we have flagged that one as well, that we'd like the advocates to consider, author and advocates to consider that exemption. And then I think the biggest factor my client has pointed out is the $1 million subsidy to PEEP to assist with the bidding requirements. My client, for the record, has lived under the aggregate claims data requirement to give to organizations for the last 8 years. That's a requirement this committee put on them a number of years ago. We bid for over 600 local units of government and 8 cooperative pools. And, it takes a lot of time and energy to put those bids together, and we'd hate to see our competitors be $1 million further down the road out of the chute. So we've raised that as an issue, too, with the author. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we're here today hoping to get out of the way of this bill if we can, but we're not quite there yet. Still working on some of these issues, but appreciate the tenor of the legislation that's go around. With that, I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Walseth. Ms. Commit.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
Back.
Thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm here representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I will also echo what Mr. Walseth said. We have been having, it's been a very refreshing experience we've been having working with Ed Minnesota this year. We've been negotiating on this legislation. I really think that we're making progress, and so I just wanted to let the members know that we're continuing to work with both the author and with Ed Minnesota and other stakeholders to make this bill a workable solution. Thank you,
Ms. Kmit. And finally on the list, I have Ms. Dietrich. Denise Dietrich. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association. The Minnesota School Boards Association represents every school board member in the state of Minnesota. So that is over 2,000 school board members. When this bill first came out, I must tell you, we had a day at the Capitol around that time, and so we were presenting the bill to our school board members as they were going to, before they were going to come and visit the Capitol. And when we were preparing the presentation, the only thing we could think of is on this bill is, thank God it's not PEEP. And so we are just so grateful that the author has taken comments and concerns about the traditional way of doing the PEEP bill and now reformed it into this. With that being said, though, we do have some concerns about the bill, and I would like to just outline a few of them. But as the other testifiers indicated, we'll be working with the author of the bill, and we look forward to that, and we trust the fact that she will be working with us and listening very well to our concerns. So, from the school board members' point of view, we have a couple of concerns, and I'm going to outline them. The first is in the bill on page 2, towards the middle. This bill does expand the open meeting law standards to non-elected officials. The author has tightened that up a little bit and added language that they will be talking about healthcare issues or health insurance. But it still does, no matter which way you look at it, it is expanding the open meeting law. And so you as a legislature will need to wrestle with that and see if you really want to do that or not. Number two is that on page 3, it talks about the rebate, the insurance rebate and the split of that. From the school board member's standpoint, we would prefer that split, however you would like to split that rebate, would be in statute, because otherwise we will have 333 school districts splitting different ways for different rationales. The third thing is, as was mentioned before, this bill does give preference to PEEP. And in the one example that I will give is the $1 million revenue to PEEP each year, and we just need to ask ourselves, is that really truly competitive then? And then are on the same playing field. The fourth thing I want to mention is that this statute references sealed bid process. We would strongly suggest that you use maybe some different language, such as proposal process, because what that would allow us to do is to negotiate after the bids are opened and negotiate with the providers, and as other people have mentioned, just provide more flexibility in general. The fifth thing I'd like to mention is there is a section in this bill that refers to the school board's members being compensated. We want to just be on record as saying that our school board members are locally elected public servants. They run for office to make a difference in public education, and it is a thankless job, and we do not feel it is needed. That there is a history that requires that they be singled out as so that they do not in the bill. So we already have statutes that deals with ethics in school board members, and if you were interested in where that is, I can get that to you. So we would like to just continue using that legislation instead. The other thing that we would like to suggest, number 6, is that you carve out the self-insured school districts. We are hearing from them that this process does not fit into their model. And number seven, the requiring three bids, one of them being PEEP, that might not work for some local school districts. Some local school districts, depending on their size, might not have access to three different insurers. And so that might have some unintended consequences. And with that, Mr. Chairman, those are our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to the bill? Representative Murphy, anything that you want to say in response briefly, and then we'll see if there's any questions that members have. But I saw you were scribbling copious notes with respect to the constructive suggestions.
Mr. Chair, I won't be able to read my notes when I'm done, but I was scribbling copiously. What you've heard from a variety of the testifiers is information that is in the thick of the negotiation that is underway. So I will tell you that there were a couple of things that I think were misconceptions in terms of the testimony, but you can hear as people are talking sort of a nexus about of a concern around a certain number of issues, and we are already working on providing amendments in order to address those issues. And with that, if you'd like, I would love to take your questions.
And actually, what I'd say to members, by the way, this is obviously a bill that needs to make multiple committee stops. Traditionally, what we've done with bills like this, obviously, any time a bill comes to committee, you want to have every single thing, every bit of punctuation sorted out before it leaves committee. What we do sometimes when you have a bill that needs to make multiple stops is I expect that we're going to progress to the next committee today with an acknowledgement of the issues that have been identified. And I really genuinely appreciate everybody that's come with their constructive suggestions on how to improve the bill. What I'll then do is visit with Representative Hoppe as we follow the bill through the process. Assuming that those items have been addressed, Representative Hoppe and I will talk. If need be, we'll bring the bill back or some version of the bill back to see if there's any lingering issues. But I just didn't want you to think that we're just washing our hands of it. We'll have to visit before it hits the floor, and we'll figure out where things are at. But with that, are there questions or concerns that people have or things that they want to echo of testimony that's been heard? Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I appreciate you saying that. I have worked on this issue for a long time, and Representative Murphy, I like the tack you're taking here, the sides getting together to negotiate. I think it's fairly clear there are going to be a lot of changes. Everybody seems to be working and playing nicely together, heading towards that elusive peace in the valley. There are a number of things that I have concerns about, I think almost all of which were addressed up there, but we'll wish you luck and remain to, I guess we'll either see it again or follow the progress nicely.
Thanks, Representative Hoppe. And Mr. Chair, I do want to let the committee members know that Chair Atkins and I talked yesterday on the floor, and I do understand that as we progress, there's a chance that we'll be back to talk through the progress that we're making, and that I'm wide open to that. I want to make sure that Commerce Committee gets a look, if that's what you request.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, I have several concerns, and some of them were highlighted here by the folks that came forward to testify. I represent school districts that are primarily self-insured, and one of them, the Wayzata School District, came to me and left this note and said, please continue to strongly advocate for an opt-out. As you know, this bill will most likely be detrimental to our school district and our health insurance costs. And I'm very concerned in the fact that we are not having an opt-out for the self-insured for all the reasons that were highlighted here today. I kind of see this actually as a bill that's an unfunded mandate for our school districts that's going to drive up costs for property taxpayers as well as the schools themselves. And they're going to have to divert their resources to other things. But I wanted to specifically ask you, in the bill you have here that you are going to require them to go and rebid every 2 years, which, you know, industry standards, you know, typically goes from 3 to 5 years. What was the logic behind having the contracts at 2 years?
Either Representative Murphy or Mr. Radke. Mr. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that came in line initially as part of the majority of school district health insurance contracts are 1 to 2 years. We did a survey of our districts, and we found of the 240 districts that responded to us, only 40 have contracts that are beyond 2 years. And then one of the author's amendments in the bill that we did was say then, if truly there is a good deal that the district has got for 3 to 5 years or beyond the 2-year time frame, as long as there's agreement between the school district and the exclusive rep, you could extend that time period and go beyond the 2 years if you wanted to. And then we also addressed the issue by saying original language said you had to do it every time your contractor expired or every 2 years, and we also amended it to say it doesn't have to be more than once every 2 years. So if you are in an annual contract, you wouldn't have to do the full RFP process every year. It would have to be once every other year. So we tried to make some accommodation to that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my concern is we now are in the business of doing a lot on the healthcare side of things, and we happen to put in place MNsure, and that has not been going so well for us. And my concern, Representative Murphy, is considering all the glitches that have transpired with MNsure, why do we think that we now can tell these self-insured school districts that have done a lot of legwork to lower their costs for their employees, why do we feel that now we're going to tell them how they need to do their business? And they have come forward here and said, quite frankly, that this is going to drive up their costs and that this is an unfunded mandate for these school districts. Why do we think, given all of our history with MNsure, that this is the right way to go?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. And I think I heard the testifiers talk about a number of questions and maybe some concerns about costs, but I don't think they were definitive in that. From my perspective, the operating principle underneath this legislation is about competition and transparency, and we know that, and we believe that, and we've heard testimony that those school districts that use multiple bids as a means to drive down costs are having success. And I understand the way the bill is drafted right now, there is somewhat of an apples and oranges experience for the self-insureds. But I think the question for us and the question that we'll be talking about is the mechanism or the tool of competition a valuable tool even for the self-insured plans? So while they may not be seeking 3 fully insured bids, would the idea of competition applied to third-party administrators and their administrative costs be a way to drive down costs? I think that is the question that we will put to those who came to testify today and others and see if we can find a solution around that. I fully understand the work that the self-insured districts are doing and self-insurance and what's happening in the market. I want you to know or recognize that this legislation is building on a process that's already in place. So we're building upon something that's already happening and trying to take the best of that and make sure that it's applied across the state of Minnesota. So we're using competition across the state of Minnesota to the best of our ability in order to drive down costs. And I think that's something that will yield a good result and something that many of us can agree is a tool that would be fruitful for our school districts, the school employees, and for the property taxpayers.
And Representative Anderson, you had another comment, then I'm going to go to Representative Swedzinski.
Final comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. You know, the testimony that we heard, though, today, talking about the ability to continue to negotiate, we now are taking away a tool from these folks to be able to continue to negotiate on their plans by how this bill is drafted. And if you truly want to have competition, you make it fair for all and not give an advantage to one group over other groups. And I don't see that in this bill as it is currently drafted. But I do appreciate your willingness to work on the matter. Thank you.
And Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. Kind of along the lines of the self-insured plans, you know, obviously there's some large deposits in accounts that have been set up and paid into. Let's say that we're kind of just lay out a scenario. What happens to that account? You know, that all the teachers and employees have paid into, that they have got some money out that they make their payments out of in collections as something happens. What happens to those if a PEEP or another group would take over that insuring of that group? What happens to those funds?
Mr. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedzinski. I'm sorry, I might get that.
That's all right.
Name right. I apologize.
The member
for that.
From Lyon.
Swedzinski. Okay, thanks. Yes. I don't have the answer for that off the top of my head, but we can find that for you. I can guess, but I would even hazard a guess. But generally, I don't even want to hazard a guess. I don't want to say something false that I'd have to correct for later. But
Representative Murphy.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Swedzinski. I believe that those funds that are within the district's control, if the district chose PEEP, those funds would remain within the district's control. So the decision-making underneath this piece of legislation isn't being significantly altered. What we're trying to do is put forth alternatives through competition. So if there's a self-insured group right now and they chose PEEP, the funds that they have in reserve that were for their self-insured plan would not the district that controls those now would not lose that control.
And Representative Swedzinski.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, Representative Murphy, kind of going along that, kind of changing that, I guess I kind of wanted to maybe bring up one of the, I think it was Eden Prairie School District, Prior Lake, they came up and spoke about that. I kind of maybe wanted to ask them if they had some thoughts about if they've kind of done some scenarios of what would happen if that would possibly happen. Is there anything that kind of...
And the only thing, gentlemen, that I'd ask is if you can be relatively brief. We've got like nine other bills to get after. Representative Schitzky, you want to pose your question?
Yes. I just kind of wanted to ask you that same question. Just, you know, if you guys kind of talked about that scenario, what would happen internally between your relationship? Obviously, these are negotiated. How these payments happen as far as being self-insured, what would you foresee would happen to those funds? Obviously, you kind of understand what the situation would be, who's driving this on that. What do you think would happen to those funds?
Mr. Mons.
And that's simply one of the concerns that we do have is just a lack of a real clear answer on that. We know that currently, statutorily, those funds need to be used if they remain with the district to support employee health care costs. That being said, if we were to transition to a fully insured model, that is one of the questions that we do have.
Okay. And last up, Representative Woodard.
Oh,
I'm sorry. My apologies. Representative Swedzinski.
Sorry, just a general comment, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, as a, whenever you have a sealed bid situation, I always view that as a person, you bid on land and buy a farm and other products, that a sealed bid buys you a place at the table. Essentially, you put a bid on of earnest money, you come forward, you do the work, and it would be my encouragement that that buys you a seat at the table for negotiation. That is not a be-all, end-all, because when we talk about transparency, we talk about a conversation, I would just encourage a fine representative to really look at that, to open that up, and keep that conversation as vigorous as possible. Right? Thank you.
And that's helpful. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, do you know what the path is, the committee path for this bill will be?
Representative Murphy.
I do, but I don't have it memorized. So I believe that we will be next in civil law. We have to go to government operations. We have to go to education finance, and we're going to ways and means.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's great, because I think civil law may have some interest in 7.6 to 7.8, where it talks about providing group insurance coverage to a school district must provide the school district with non-identifiable aggregate claims. And as someone who represents, obviously, some smaller school districts as well, that can be difficult from a privacy standpoint. So hopefully that'll be addressed in civil law. And so the only other question I had, Mr. Chair, was the $1 million appropriation. Can you kind of walk through what that the intent of that $1 million, and I think it's an annual appropriation? Or
as we drafted the legislation, because we were requiring PEEP in the legislation to provide a bid. And we know that the work of that would be spread across the current enrollees of PEEP. We didn't want to do that without considering an appropriation. As we have considered and continued conversations with both the service co-ops and the health plans, it is shaping our thinking about that, and it is an open question as we're going forward.
Thank you. And, well, we're not technically the Finance Committee for this particular bill. That's a good question. Also, Representative Hoppe, I said Representative Woodard was the last one, but Representative Hoppe said he's got a little one.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, you've heard these concerns. I think we have some other concerns. I appreciate your willingness to work with everybody. I hope you're consulting with the folks over here on the self-funded people. And I don't know if we need to see it again, but I appreciate that direction. But, Mr. Chair, I would like to have a roll call.
Thank you. unless there's any other comments. Representative Murphy, any final words?
You know, Mr. Chair and members, I'm really grateful, one, for your respectful questioning, and also for the questioning, right, because it helps us understand where we need to go to earn support. I look forward to continuing conversations with each of you individually. I'm happy to update you as we're moving forward. A number of the things that you brought up are already in process. And with that, I thank you and ask for your vote. Thank you.
And on behalf of the committee, thank you to everyone who testified, especially those that offered constructive suggestions on how to improve it. That's what the committee process is all about. With that, clerk, call the roll.
Atkins?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hoppe?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Anzelt?
Yes.
Davids? Dean?
Yes.
Falk?
Aye.
Halverson?
Aye.
Hillstrom?
Aye.
Portman?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Lilly?
Aye.
Loon?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Schoen?
Yes.
Slocum?
Aye.
Sundin?
Yes.
Svedzinski?
No.
Tice? Woodard?
No.
Zellers?
That, of course, is on House File 2180. Be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Motion carries 13-7. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Next up is Representative Portman's bill, House File 977. Representative Portman will move that House File 977 be referred to the General Register. Welcome to your committee, Representative Portman. My understanding, for folks that are, for their planning purposes, my understanding is the next two bills will move relatively quickly, and then we're going to take up a series of liquor-related bills. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is an update to the Minnesota's Limited Liability Corporation Act, and I have informed my witnesses of your general approach that if it's a non-controversial bill, the more you talk, the more votes you can lose. So they've been forewarned. But with that, I would like to introduce to the committee Gene Hennig, who will explain what the bill does.
And thank you, Representative Portman. It's my understanding that the 814-0760 amendment is an author's amendment to put it in the shape that you'd like to proceed. Is that true?
Yes, sir.
All right. Then all in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none, motion carries. Sir, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chairman Atkins. My name, for the record, is Gene Hennig. I'm a practicing lawyer here in the state of Minnesota, business lawyer, as is Mr. Wacholtz, who's with me this afternoon. I am also a uniformed law commissioner, as is Representative Portman. And so this statute that we're considering this afternoon is a so-called Uniform Act, which means that it's been very carefully vetted by the Uniform Law Commission and has received a great deal of study before we got here this afternoon. It's also important, I think, to note at the outset that this bill has no known opposition among the business community, among consumer communities, and among the legal communities. So it is a bill that, with my humble suggestion, ought to go forward quickly if you're so inclined. Let me, I think the best way to introduce this subject to you this afternoon, the committee, is to raise and answer quickly four or five basic questions about why this legislation is important to enact for the state of Minnesota. Question number one, what's a limited liability company? Most of you probably already know that. Those of you who are lawyers, those of you who are in business, probably know the answer to that question. But for those of you who may need a quick refresher, a limited liability company is a form of business entity, just like a corporation is, just like a partnership is. And its defining characteristic, as its name suggests, is that the liability of its members, its shareholders, if you will, is limited. It's limited, and that's what's its special feature. It also has favorable tax characteristics. And so as a result, increasingly, entrepreneurs, business people here in the state of Minnesota who want to form business entities are choosing the limited liability company over and against the corporate model, which is what it has historically been in the past. Question number two, what is this revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act? What is this animal that we're asking you to adopt? Minnesota already has a limited liability company statute dating back to 1992. But what we're asking you to do now is to adopt this thing called the Revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. We're asking you to adopt the uniform version because that would bring us more fully into line with what's happening in other states and make us a more attractive business environment in which to do business. There are many advantages to adopting the Revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act, but the biggest one is really, as I said, to bring Minnesota into conformity with what's happening in other states. At the present time, our act is similar to only one other statute in all of the United States. By adopting the Uniform Act that we're proposing this afternoon, we would become in line with the model that's being employed in other states. Currently, for your information, there are 9 states that have adopted this statute, and we would be the 10th. Question number 3, why is the adoption of this statute so important? Why are we making such a big deal about this? As I alluded to earlier, the limited liability company model that many of you are familiar with has now become the preferred business entity with which to do business in this state. Just to give you some ideas to how important it's become, over the course of the last 20 years, since the time we first adopted the LLC statute in this state, roughly 80% of all business entities are now limited liability companies. For those of you that think corporations are still the model, you need to be brought up to date. Nowadays, instead of partnerships, instead of corporations, instead of S-corps that some of you are familiar with from the old days, the overriding majority of business entities that are being formed are limited liability companies. So it's important that we have a good statute and one that's a modern statute. Okay, question number 4. Why is it that the existing law needs to change? I mean, we've got a limited liability company statute. What is there that requires us to go through the effort now of changing it? Well, the biggest reason really is the existing statute is built more on a corporate model as opposed to a partnership model. And the reason for that is because we were one of the first statutes to adopt the LLC form of entity here in Minnesota. We were one of the pioneers, if you will, back in 1992 to adopt this form of entity. While we were one of the first, the rest of the world sort of passed us by and went in another direction. And so our form of statute is really at variance with what one finds throughout the rest of the country. And so again, it makes it a lot easier for us to do business if, in fact, we are dealing with what I'm referring to as a partnership model. Another big thing about this is that given where we are today, Minnesota lawyers and businesses are pretty much are oftentimes almost forced to go look elsewhere for the places to form their business entity. For example, a lot of times we have to go to the state of Delaware, which is not very desirable because Delaware's statutes in this regard are not necessarily advantageous for lawyers and businesses. It's expensive to use those statutes. Were we to adopt the Revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act, we could form business entities here that would be far better and cheaper for our businesses and business owners alike. There are many reasons, as I said, for adopting the Revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. I would emphasize again that it is a uniform act, which means that it's been thoroughly vetted. It's been thoroughly studied. The last point I'll make is that Minnesota really has its fingerprints all over the statute already. And the reason I say that is that 4 people from Minnesota had a big hand in drafting this thing from the beginning. And those 4 people, these names may be familiar to some of you, Professor Kleinberger from William Mitchell is one of them. Professor Carter Bishop, formerly from William Mitchell, was one of them. They were the co-reporters or authors of this statute. And then other people that had a hand in it, Harry Hansworth, the former dean of William Mitchell,
He was a member of the drafting committee. And last but not least, Judge Harriet Lansing, currently the president of the Uniform Law Commission, also had a substantial hand in drafting this thing. So our fingerprints are all over this thing. Now's the time, I would submit, for Minnesota to join a growing number of states in adopting this statute, which, finally, one more time, is not opposed by any group that I'm aware of here in the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hennig.
And Mr. Chair, we have an additional testifier to answer questions only. Just wanted to introduce himself since he made the trip over.
My name is Wade Wackles. I'm with Gislason and Hunter. I'm a practicing lawyer and work with a lot of small business owners and forming these kind of entities. And worked on the committee that the Bar Association that studied this this act and recommends its approval.
Very good. And gentlemen and Representative Hortman, thank you both. I have a series of questions, 10, 11, something like that. I'm just kidding. But I do appreciate the thorough review. And Mr. Hennig, thank you for your efforts, not just on this, but on behalf of the bar generally, your credit to the profession. And it's we appreciate having you here. Not that you're not, by the way, but I've been
someday
hearing about,
when I grow up,
been hearing
I
about
like
him
Mr.
for a
Hennig,
long.
Yes.
Unless there's questions for the author or for either the two testifiers, Representative Hortman then will renew her motion that House File 977, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Gentlemen, thank you. Representative Hortman, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, the last non-liquor-related bill is actually mine. So the Chair will move House File 1938, be referred to the General Register. And I'll turn the gavel over to Representative Prince.
There's a gentleman there with his hands on, he's there with a tie and a shirt on.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Atkins. And you have, I see a couple of testifiers. You've moved your bill, so let's hear about your bill.
Very briefly, this is not an unusual thing. It's just Minnesota Fair Plan employees. There's 12, nine of whom would be eligible to purchase health insurance in the same fashion through CGIP as a number of other folks and a number of other entities. We're already allowed to do that. It should have no financial impact upon the state. It'll be picked up. The tab will be picked up by the Fair Plan, but hopefully it'll save them some money. With that, I'd appreciate members' support. I've got a couple folks here to answer questions and provide brief testimony, but that's a quick summary.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Bert McAsee from Lindquist and Venom here on behalf of the Fair Plan. With me is Mr. Dan Johnson, who's been the executive director for the last 15 years, doing a fine job. One of his strong suits is that he believes in brevity, so he's going to take 2 minutes to briefly describe the reason for this legislation, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. As mentioned, my name is Daniel Johnson. I'm the executive director of Minnesota Fair Plan. To be perfectly honest, I don't know that I could give a better description of what you've already heard. The basic premise is that we would hope to be granted the ability to purchase our insurance as a member of a large group, with all the benefits that come along with being members of a large group. The hope is to keep our health insurance expenses as low as possible, which indirectly benefits the consumers of all property insurance in the state of Minnesota. As if we run light on money, we have the power to assess, and that eventually would that would be assessing the member companies that eventually would be passed on to any consumer of their products. So for that reason, we try our best to keep our expenses as low as we can, and this, we hope, will allow us to do that in the area of health insurance. I don't think there's much more I can add to that.
Well, thank you to the testifiers and members. Are there any questions? Representative Swedinski, I see you're on board.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of just a general overview question talking about the fair. Fair Act here, and is there an aversion to go into MnCare? Is there what is there roadblocks
well,
that we could
Mr.
clear
Johnson.
Up?
Madam Chair and Mr. Swedzinski, the difficulty we face is that we are currently under the provisions of the Small Business Health Reform Act, which has somewhat stringent underwriting, such as age banding, is one of the things that they do. Plus, our experience is based Our rates are based on our experience. Our experience is only 9 people. So as a result, the benefit of being in a larger group is that there is no age banding, and the experience is spread across far more people who are covered by the plan. As a result, it costs less and has less of an impact if a single member of our staff should suffer some medical misfortune. That will have an effect on everyone in our group that pays premiums. Whereas if we go into a larger group, such as suggested, that would not happen, and our individual members of our staff would not be penalized for the bad health of one individual person. So that would be the reason why we would look to this. Staying in that area, my understanding is we would still be under the terms of the Small Business Health Reform Act, and so that would really not solve our issue. Hopefully that answers the question.
Okay, Representative Swedinski, was that good? All right. Are there any other questions, members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience want to testify for or against this bill? I don't see anyone. So, Representative Atkins, House File 1938. Any last words?
The motion that House File
1938 be referred to the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The bill is on its way.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. All right, folks, logistically, it's now 5:15. Our committee normally goes till 5:30. We're going to run a little bit late, or 5:45, I guess we go until. We're going to go a little bit late, but as I told you last week, we're not going to have a hearing tomorrow. So there is a little bit of a trade-off. All of the bills that are about to come up are liquor-related bills. They will be laid over for potential inclusion in an omnibus liquor bill. The first item up, I believe, are there any non-members of the Commerce Committee that are in the room? Representative Clark, I saw you earlier. Then we'll start with Representative Clark's bill. That is House File 1972. And the chair will move that House File 1972 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Actually, first we'll move the bill, and then we'll lay it over once we get to the conclusion of it. So Representative Clark's bill is for the American Swedish Institute caterer's license being allowed. To all of our members, and I know Representative Clark knows this, in light of the hour at this point, to the extent you can be relatively brief in your testimony, that probably enhances your chances of being eventually included in the omnibus liquor bill. Representative Clark, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So please pass this bill.
Aye. All in favor?
Well, we will give you a little description, and I've got with me here is Bruce Karstad from the American Swedish Institute. I'm going to let him explain. It's a very simple bill, transferring some details of an already existing liquor license.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity. The American Swedish Institute has long had a liquor license, which has allowed us to serve liquor as a part of our services in a coffee shop, which was in our original headquarters, the Turnbot Mansion. Dramatic change of circumstances over the past couple of years. We've expanded our campus. We built a new cultural center, included a cafe, and have greatly expanded our food service and catering services for our members, visitors, and the community. This necessitates us really to shift to a different business model rather than one of us owning and operating the cafe and food services, but instead to contract with a third party food service company, much like the Walker Arts Center, the Minnesota Center for Book Arts, Museum of Russian Art. Current legislation doesn't allow us to do that, and so we're just simply asking for an amendment that would bring us into conformity with what's being enjoyed by other similarly situated nonprofit museums and cultural centers.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Karstad. If everyone else could follow your example, that was a terrific overview. Are there questions for Mr. Karstad? If not, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Dean.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Clark and Mr. Karstad. As I look at the changes on 310, and, well, 39 and 310, it says, or to its concessionaires or operators for use on the premises owned by the American Swedish Institute at 2600 Park Avenue South. I'm assuming that this applies to the current campus and wouldn't apply to any other facilities that the American Swedish Institute may purchase in the future.
That's true.
Okay. Mr. Karstad, yeah. Representative Dean, anything further?
No, that's it.
Are there any other questions? If not, House File 1972 is laid over for possible inclusion in the House
Thank
Amendment
you very much.
Liquor Bill.
Thank you,
Mr. Karstad. Thank you, Representative Clark. Next up, any other non-members of the Commerce Committee that are in the room? All right, we'll go to Representative Slocum's bill is House File 1808. Representative Slocum will move that House File 1808 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Liquor Omnibus Bill. And you appear to be accompanied by an expert, Representative Slocum, so to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to say that my expert is a ranger.
I move the bill. Yeah. All done.
No, Croatian Slovenian. Close enough.
Close enough?
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chair. What this bill does is we've got probably one of the best kept entertainment secrets. And it's because we're having a hard time getting publicity for it, in the metro area, and that is the Magicians Hockey. If you haven't been to a game, you are missing the boat. And I would like to personally invite you to a game on me the 29th of March. It's a Saturday. If you're interested in going, please let me know, because it is so much fun. They're young men. They play some hockey. It is rough and tumble. They skate like crazy. They fight for their goals. It is wonderful. And it's really a fun evening. And the evening is enhanced with a temporary allowance to use to a 3-2 to use the beer and liquor, sell beer and liquor at the games. You can get popcorn. You can get nachos. You can get a hot dog. You can... It's an evening of fun, and I'm serious. If you want to go, come talk to me. Anyway, we would like to get a license for this and have it be ongoing because they will be playing in our ice arena from here on, I'm hoping. I also have a small oral amendment that just cleans up language, if the chair would and the committee would.
As an author's amendment, why don't we take it right away? Representative
Slocum. Right away? All right. As you read the bill, when you get down to line 1.8, where it says a junior hockey league, I want to add the word professional before junior. So it would read the owner of a professional junior hockey league. And then further down in the bill, same thing, line 1.13, persons attending professional junior hockey league games at the arena. So just adding the word professional.
Okay.
And that cleans it up and clarifies.
It's an author's amendment, inserting two words to the bill. Everyone clear with the, and staff clear with what that does?
Now I can support it.
And then I have my city manager, Mr. Steve Devich, who will give you a little bit of additional information, and he will be brief.
Very good. Welcome, Mr. Devich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Devich. As the representative indicated, I'm the city manager of the city of Richfield. I'll be brief, and I have a tendency to speak fast, so it'll make it even better. The Minnesota Magicians are a junior hockey league team. They're the only one in the metro area. And the last one, I think, was the Twin City Vulcans, and they ceased operations in 2000. They partnered with the city of Richfield. They wanted to use the Richfield Ice Arena because of the venue that we have as their home ice. That thrills us. It's a great partnership between the Minnesota Magicians and the city of Richfield. And all we're lacking is the ability to be able to sell
strong beer, so malt liquor, on-sale malt liquor and wine license. You know, if you go to any other sporting event, Vikings, Twins, St. Paul, Saints, whomever, you know, you've got your beverage in one hand and your snack in the other, and we're simply asking that that be allowed here. It's only for the Minnesota Magicians, no other event at our ice arena, and we would carefully, very carefully, control that sale.
Thank you, Mr. Devich. Well, and until we had the amendment, I was wondering if it was like Squirts or Bantams or something when it was just junior hockey, but that would be an interesting take on it. By the way, we've got that oral amendment before us. All in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Unless there's other questions for Mr. Devich or for Representative Slocum. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slocum, I'm just wondering if you play the Granite City Lumberjacks.
To the extent you know.
I don't think so, but that is another junior hockey team that we have in the St. Cloud area. So we'll have to check it out next year and see.
I would have
to
check, yeah. Yeah. It's really fun. It's a night of fun.
Yeah. We sell beer in St. Cloud.
they just bring it to the game, I'm guessing. All right, unless there's any other questions, then Representative Slocum will renew her motion that House File 1808 be laid over for possible inclusion in liquor omnibus bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Actually, I'm sorry. We just lay it over. The chair has that sort of prerogative. So it's officially laid over. Mr. Devich, thank you for taking the time to join us today. It's my understanding Representative Davney has joined us. Is that? There he is. Welcome back, Representative Davney. The chair will move whatever number your bill is, House File 2435, that'd be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I miss the Commerce Committee.
I know you do.
It's been a couple
You're
of years.
Always welcome back, your Representative Daddy.
I'm not on the committee, but it's not because I didn't ask. So, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2435, excuse me, I picked it up from the chair. Is a bill to change the classification of wineries in Minnesota from farm wineries to small wineries to expand the opportunities for business people as well as consumers in the state to be able to have wineries in our local communities on a level playing field and develop another dimension of some of the exciting changes in the alcohol industry in Minnesota. We've seen craft beer and microbreweries emerge dramatically. We are seeing micro distilleries explode across the state. Wineries is perhaps the third leg of that stool. That we've still got some pretty restrictive our statute on, and this bill looks to change that and align wineries with other parts of the liquor industry. With me tonight is a gentleman, Mr. Zeitler, who is a hopes to be a winery operator in my district. And Mr. Chair, if we could, I'd like to hand the microphone over to him.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. I've been an amateur winemaker for a little over 20 years now. I started in my dorm room at the U of M. And usually people enjoy what I make, not always. But I've had enough people say, you ought to make this stuff and sell it, that my wife and I started looking at actually doing that about a year ago. We purchased a foreclosed building on East Lake Street in Minneapolis, fixed it up. It was vacant. We thought that was the hard part until we started looking into the licensing laws for wineries other than farm wineries, and we found out that we were very wrong. That was the difficult part of this project, was trying to get licensed as a winery on less than 3 acres, not in an agricultural area. I don't know if the purple handout has gone out, but yeah, the purple handout kind of illustrates the difficulties of running a winery in a non-rural area, in a city or a town or a village, any place that's not zoned agricultural. We pay 10 times what a farm winery pays, and we have far fewer rights and privileges than farm wineries. All we are asking for is equal treatment under the law, I guess, at this point. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
And thank you. Are there questions either for, was it Mr. Zeitler or Zeitler?
Yep.
Zeitler. Are there questions for Representative Davney or Mr. Zeitler? Or is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to House File 2435? All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. With that, House File 2435 is laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Hortman, are you ready for House File 2161? That is a request by the City of Brooklyn Park for an on-sale and tax-sitting liquor license. Representative Hortman moves House File 2161 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. House Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As members probably know by now, there's certain exemptions we have to give to entities at the state law level. Usually municipalities give the liquor license, but if the entity getting the liquor license isn't open all 7 days of the week to the public, then we've got to do a special exemption in state law. And the format of the Brooklyn Park exemption matches, my understanding is, the other 80 that already exist in state law. And what it is there's a bar that was on the banks of the Mississippi River that turned into a problem property, is torn down, and it has been purchased and will turn into a wedding event center, and they'll just rent it out for weddings. They'd like to serve alcohol at the weddings. But if they get a liquor license, we have to do it through state law. And there's no known opposition, and the development won't go forward without the bill passing.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Hortman? Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to House File 2161? If not, Representative Hortman will lay over House File 2161 for potential inclusion in liquor omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe, you got a twofer. Do you have a preference on which one you go for?
You can go in numerical order.
All right. Well, then House File 2199 is moved by Representative Hoppe be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, I will give a brief description, and I bring guests.
A lot of guests.
We are here talking about farm wineries, and we really have a lot of guests. I'll get out of the way and let them let the experts tell.
Ms. Maloney, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is John Maloney. My wife and I own the Cannon River Winery down in Cannon Falls, Minnesota. And we started that back in 2001. We planted a 20-acre vineyard down in the Sogan Valley. We opened up our winery in the fall of 2004 to coincide with our first harvest. In addition to that, I sit on the board of directors for the Minnesota Grape Growers Association, and I have with me here Kent Schwickert. He's my co-chair of the legislative committee, and Ron Barnes is our MGGA president. So I got roped into chairing the legislative committee 4 years ago, and I finally got some help with me this year. So the bill before you, basically we see this as some clarification and cleanup, and then a couple of points that really point to the growth and success that our industry has had. So I thought I would just take a couple of minutes and go through these changes with you, and then if Kent or anybody would like to add anything, we can talk further and open it up for questions. So first of all, with regard to excise tax exemption, we are asking for the distilled spirits and bulk wine that we're bringing in under license that these be exempt from taxes. Currently, first of all, I want you to understand these are ingredients that we can bring in. We bring in distilled spirits to fortify some of our products to produce a port wine, and it's just they're simply ingredients, and we're paying excise tax on the finished product when it goes back out the door, but there's been some issue on whether or not those ingredients are a taxable event, and we feel that they're not. The bulk distilled spirits and bulk wine definitions, those are just clarifications to let us all know and understand what we mean when we say bulk wine. They're just quantities. The change from 50,000 gallons to 250,000 gallons, that just mirrors what's currently considered a small producer at the federal level. The TTB definition of a small producer is up to 250,000 gallons. And we've had good growth. That 50,000 gallon cap has been here since the farm winery law was put in place in the 70s. And with the growth that we've had in our industry, we know it's time to start moving that 50,000 gallon cap up. The storage issue, we just simply need flexibility to store our products off-site. It's really an issue of when you have a facility of a certain size and you have a larger harvest, or you're bringing in more fruit and you're producing more product, we simply need places to store that on an increasing basis. That's happening a lot more often, and we'd like to have the ability to store that product off-site, you know, per state regulations and federal requirements. So, and then the last change, the bulk wine and bulk distilled spirits. This just clarifies really that we can buy those products. Currently, we can use those in our winery, but we want a definition in our farm winery law saying that yes, we can buy those products. It's already allowed that we can produce, for example, port wine, which requires neutral grain spirits, but there's not necessarily a good definition in our law that shows that we can buy those products. So we're just using them in our winemaking process. So I'll open it up, Kent.
I just have a couple comments that I'm sorry.
No, I just said thank you. Okay. We do that here. If you can simply identify yourself and give your name for the record.
I'm Kent Schwickert. I'm with Chancasket Creek Ranch and Winery from Kasota, Minnesota. I think John has pretty much laid out the primary points of the bill that we're proposing to introduce. To take a step further, what we really are trying to do is align ourselves with current federal regulations. Many of the things that we're trying to do actually are clearly stated within federal law through the Department of Treasury and the TTB, and we're just trying to make the specificity clear for the Department of Public Safety, because we've run into these problems in the past where we haven't been able to do it, yet the answer we get is please clarify the law, and so that's why we're here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tricker. Yes, sir.
I'm Ronald Barnes. I'm the president of the Minnesota Grape Growers Association. The farm winery bill originally was passed a very long time ago, and it's just come to fruition in the last decade or so. The Minnesota Grape Growers Association has about 500 members, and over substantially all of the wineries in the state, which number almost 50, are members of our association as well. We're simply trying to create an environment here where our industry can grow and to remove some of these barriers that are in the way. In 2007, we had an economic impact study showing that our industry produces about $36 million of economic impact, about one third from the growing the grapes, one third from the wineries, and another third from tourism. A more recent study in 2011 shows that number is now $59 million. And along with that, we've grown the number of jobs from 324, I think it was, in 2007, to now over 3,000. We're an important part of the economy of Minnesota, and we'd ask your support for our changes.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Gentlemen, I don't know who's best to answer. I was wondering how many or which wineries are pushing up close to the 50,000-gallon, the current 50,000-gallon limit. Whoever wants to answer that, I don't know who would be best. But Ms. Maloney?
Which wineries are?
How many wineries are? I'm just trying to get
my
understanding
is there's
like 500 wineries. Are there 50 of them that are right up against it?
There's at least a half a dozen that are within shouting distance of that number, which is still 2 or 3 years out before you'd really have that ceiling, but we thought we should start addressing that now.
Sure. Do you have the ability to get us a list maybe of the 5 or 10 or whatever? I'm not dictating a number, but what number they're at in terms of the production on an annual basis? I'd just like to, and what we're going to do is, you guys have probably picked up from the discussion, we're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. So we've got a week or a couple weeks before we actually put the overall bill together. So sometime in the next few days or a week, if you could find out how many are pushing up against the current cap, I think that would be helpful for folks. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will you also follow the three-tier alcohol distribution system that other folks follow when they distribute alcohol?
One of you guys, Mr. Frick?
The farm winery allows us to sell and distribute our wine from our tasting rooms and also to sell direct to restaurants and liquor stores. So we are not concurrent with the the three-tier system. We never have been.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much of the wine, then, would you anticipate would be coming from outside of Minnesota that would be contributing to these 250,000 gallons that you could sell and store off-site?
It would not change. It would still be the majority have to be grown in Minnesota.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, this question might be for you. Would this bill then need to go to the public safety committees because will they have to then follow the same rules that other transportation has to follow when shipping alcohol approval through the Department of Public Safety?
Representative Hillstrom, I don't chair public safety. If a chair of another committee were to make an argument for having the bill go to their committee, it'd darn well go to their committee. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just ask these folks.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Do you anticipate then that you would follow the same process for approval for moving your wine that all the other liquor industry has to follow when they're shipping their alcohol from place to place?
To the extent you can answer that question, I see a little befuddled question, but I assume any laws that apply you will follow?
Yeah.
Mr. Schwickert? Absolutely. Representative Maloney?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, you may want to ask it a little different way, maybe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shipping of alcohol has to go through an approval process through the Department of Public Safety. So would you anticipate that your movement of alcohol would then should have to follow that same procedure for all other movement of alcohol? You think the farm wineries then would follow that process as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Are you referring to the having the ability to store the wine in another facility, or are you talking about transporting it to other liquor stores and restaurants or customers?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be whenever you move it. So if you have it on your farm and then you're going to store it somewhere else, I assume that's moving liquor from one place to another. When you're moving it from where you store it to wherever you distribute it to, I would assume that would follow the same structure that all other folks have to follow.
Well, we're following. Would follow would be the rules of the TGB. TGB is pretty clear about where you're moving your product and where it's storing it, and you have to have your records accordingly.
Representative Hillstrom, anything further?
No, Mr. Chair, I'll just make sure that public safety requests the bill if it makes it into your bill.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Representative Hoppe, anything further to the bill? Otherwise, we'll just lay it over for possible inclusion.
Not for me, Mr. Chair, other than thank you. Thank you for all the questions, members.
Yep. Gentlemen, thank you for taking the time for us this afternoon. We appreciate it. House File 2199 is laid over for possible inclusion of the Liquor Omnibus Bill. Representative Hoppe, and then I saw Representative Lean has joined us as well. So we'll take up Representative Hoppe's House File 2200. Micro distillery sales expanded. Representative Hoppe moves that House File 2200 be laid over for possible inclusion in the House Liquor Bill. Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As with the previous bill dealing with wineries, dealing with distilleries, I have guests that know more than I do. And, you know, the intention here is just, you know, we've seen this happen over the last 10 years or so with breweries and now distilleries and wineries nationwide and all over the state. And I think we're seeing it because that's what our citizens and our constituents are looking for. So I'm going to turn it over to the experts.
All right. We'd like to hear from the baby first.
I think you just did.
Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair Atkins. My name is Chanel Montana, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Distillers Guild, and I'm also the owner of Denord Craft Spirits in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You know, at Denord, my husband and I opened up Denord because we firmly believe that the state of Minnesota can do anything better than Kentucky can do, and we believe that we have all of the resources here in Minnesota to create great craft spirits. We are here today. The Guild is here today. We have many members up in the balcony here. They're raising their hands from all across of Minnesota because we are asking the legislature to open the door for our industry to thrive, similar to how the wineries and the breweries have thrived throughout the last couple of years. This committee all we are asking for from this committee is really to update the law to be current with modern times, and to allow microdistilleries the same benefits that the breweries and the wineries currently receive, and the same benefits that they are able to give their customers. Microdistilleries have a foothold in Minnesota already. Just a couple years ago, we were here, actually last year we were here, and we were able to give samples, and we really appreciate that movement. But what had started as one or two distilleries in the state of Minnesota is now a growing industry, and we have over 20 represented just by the Guild, and we have many more that are in the works, and many more people writing business plans and getting willing to invest their savings accounts into these small businesses. The Guild over the years has grown, and we have people here to represent Duluth, Halleck, and we have many other people in the balcony from around the state of Minnesota. Distilleries are going in not only in urban areas like Minneapolis, like we're seeing many of the breweries, but we're also seeing the tie with agricultural being really strong. And so a lot of money and investment is going into rural areas as well. We are renovating old buildings, we are building new buildings, and we are also contracting with local farmers to produce the best spirits that we can by using Minnesota resources. Our build today consists of three components. It consists of cocktail sales, or a cocktail room. It consists of bottle sales from the products that we create, and also self-distribution, so that in many small towns, we are able to get our product directly to the store that may only be a block away. For cocktail sales, the sampling bill, again, we very much appreciate that. We were able to have that ability as of last year. But unfortunately, or fortunately, not many people are drinking vodka or gin straight. They want to have that cocktail in cocktail form. And it really gives us the ability to highlight our own products. It gives us the ability to best showcase our products. Bottle sales is something that we have seen a number of states throughout the Midwest be able to do. And our competitors in Wisconsin, just across the border, are able to have bottle sales. And it really completes the customer experience. Because similar to how you go to a winery and you may try a couple of wines and then you walk out with a couple of bottles, we're seeing in a number of states that allow this that we have customers going to these distilleries, taking a tour, learning about our craft, and then being able to buy a bottle or two to commemorate the experience that they just had. It goes along with that education that that customer is asking for. As far as the self-distribution, we do have a lot of members of the Guild that are in urban areas or rural areas, and self-distribution really allows us the ability to maybe not send a six-pack somewhere, but to send a couple of bottles to really test the market and get a couple of bottles in places that maybe our distributor doesn't go to, maybe a liquor store that, you know, isn't willing to take the chance of buying a 12-case bottle or a 6-case, or a 6-bottle case or a 12-bottle case. So there are three components to our bill, and really if I could just leave you with one thing, it's just that this is just creating some parity with other industries. We are not getting an excise tax decrease. We're not doing anything else. All we are doing is getting some parity with all of, with the two other liquor industries that are in the state of Minnesota. And we believe that will really make us allow us to be competitive with our neighboring states and create a growing industry. So thank you so much for your time tonight. With Thank that, you. I will turn it back over to you, Chair Atkins.
Are you here to answer questions, or you also want to testify?
Also would like to testify.
Very good. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Swanson. I'm the co-owner and distiller at Far North Spirits in just near Hallock, Minnesota. My wife and I are both from the Hallock area, but we have recently moved back to build our distillery. For those of you who represent rural districts, you know this is not insignificant for young couples to, well, kind of young, to move back and start new businesses. Kitson County, where Hallock is located, is a very small county, and so the investment that we've brought in to build our distillery from the ground up, literally, it was a field in May of last year, represents just over $1.5 million. Most of that has stayed right in the county with local contractors and businessmen. We grow all the grain that goes into our spirits that we craft into our rye whiskey and our gin. Because this distillery is located on our family farm, we're able to take advantage of the abundance of agricultural resources that are in the Red River Valley in the state of Minnesota and create something truly beautiful. Now, as far as our distillery is concerned, when people visit us, I mean, we're in Hallock, Minnesota. We're 25 miles south of the Canadian border. This winter, it's felt like we're about 25 miles north of the Arctic Circle. But despite that, we have a tremendous amount of interest in visitors that have come up and stopped by middle of nowhere to visit our distillery. It's very much a curiosity. We would love to be able to complete their experience by offering them some of our product to take home. Our numbers show that for every person that may have purchased a bottle at our distillery, over 20 would have been sold through distribution to retailers, mainly in the Twin Cities, but also in other parts of the state. In Hallock, Minnesota, which is a population of 980, more of our gin has been sold at the one liquor store in town than at Certix in downtown Minneapolis. We have a very good relationship with these folks. It's a much-needed revenue stream for them. It's a much-needed additional revenue stream for retailers all over the state. From our perspective, however, given the significant investment we've put in, cash flow is very, very necessary. This is a new startup. We started construction in late May of last year. We shipped our first product in December, and cash flow is a very necessary thing. We would love to be able to have some kind of parity with the breweries and wineries that can already do this. We're not asking for anything that they can't already do. And so I encourage you to pass this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else who desires spirit? Got one of those Minnesota standoffs. Everybody's so polite that.
Yeah. No, you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing us today. My name is Emily Vikra, and this is my husband, Joel Vikra. This is our son, Espen Vikra. Believe it or not, this is his first hearing. And we are the co-founders and owners of Vikra Distillery in Duluth, Minnesota. And I grew up in Duluth and have spent almost the last decade on the East Coast, where we've been living and working, but we decided that we wanted to come back to Minnesota and put down roots in a community, really participate in a community, and bring an exciting new business to a community, which is why we decided to move back to Duluth and start a distillery. And we felt that Minnesota was a really great place to do something like this because it has so many natural resources, so many great agricultural resources that we can form relationships with and build an exciting, creative new product from. And it also has an excellent culture based on the craft beer movement here that is supportive of craft and that's interested in creative small businesses. Joel, do you want to talk a little bit more about
that? Sure. These bottles first hit the shelves around the state about 2 weeks ago. And a single one of these bottles contains 7 pounds of malted barley, grown in Minnesota, malted in Minnesota. It contains Lake Superior water, and it contains botanicals from the Lake Superior watershed. That's all it contains, incidentally. When we start making whiskey, which we hope to do soon, that new make spirit will go into barrels made from Minnesota white oak that were coopered in Park Rapids, Minnesota. When I go to sell this bottle on the shelf, and this bottle retails for right around $30, 25 to 30%, depending on the variety, is in raw materials and packaging. 15% is taxes, combination of state and federal taxes. 20% goes to the distributor. 20% goes to the retailer. And we're left with 15 to 20% to run our business and hopefully eventually make back the $1.2 million we've invested, along with a handful of other investors. I'd like to point out that 15 to 20% that comes back to our business is less than either the distributor or the retailer make. We are located right on Lake Avenue in Canal Park in Duluth, directly adjacent to the lift bridge in the Pellucci building, in which there hasn't been manufacturing for several decades. We are bringing it back. If we were able to sell bottles from there, in an amount that to the state liquor business would be very, very minuscule, to us it would make a huge difference in our business model. We could use that extra 40% that currently goes to the distributor and the retailer to hire more people, We've hired 3 so far. I'd like to be at 8 by the end of the year if we were able to do this. And to come out with more new products sooner, continue to grow our business. But this would not just benefit us. Studies in other states have shown that it also benefits the retailers. When people go home from a tour at a distillery, maybe they bought a bottle or two, they go home, they're going to seek out that product at their home liquor store. They're going to start looking at other craft products, other Minnesota products, when they go to a bar or a restaurant. And what that leads to is premiumization. I said this was a $30 bottle. That's a pretty expensive bottle of gin. For a liquor store, selling a 30 bottle makes them a lot more money than selling an $18 bottle or a $15 bottle. So they win in this as well. We've seen this work in the state with craft wine and beer. We have seen the numbers of jobs and economic impact that craft beer has on Minnesota, and it's prodigious. We've also seen this work in other states with analogous legislation for craft distilling. Oregon now has a distillery road that rivals the Bourbon Trail in Kentucky. Colorado has done this. New York has done this. Wisconsin recently loosened up the laws a little bit. We wouldn't be here today if you had not already passed 2 things to help us. One was reducing the licensing fee, and the second was allowing us to provide samples. If you pass these additional measures, we'll be able to not just be here, but be back in the future as successful successful distillers. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Needless to say, Espen's face was not the face of the micro-distillery that I imagined here today. So are there questions? Representative Dean was on the list. Anyone else that wants to? All right, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question, I believe, would be to the bill author. The cocktail room license, do the limits that are in place for the sample rooms apply to cocktail room licenses as well, or is it anything goes with the cocktail room license?
Representative Hoppe, to the extent that you're able to answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. I did not get my way, so there will be limits on what would be in there. And I don't remember what, I thought that'd be funnier. But no, there will be limits. I don't remember what version we settled on, but that's something that we're, you know, I think we're willing to negotiate on that.
Representative Dean, anything? Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this item? Yes, sir. Sure. Yeah, we've got a couple folks still coming. So, Representative, any other representatives have questions for the testifier? All right. Then we've got 2 folks. Mr. Pletzer was, come on up. Yeah. Here we go again with the Minnesota standoff. Everybody's super polite.
Just one second, please.
Welcome.
Ross Pletzer. I was here last year. I've been here since 2009. I drafted the first microdistillery bill, and Senator Koch carried it. We took it to Senator Scheid's committee March 19, 2009. She said, interesting idea, bring it back in 2 years. We went back. She was the minority chair at the time. Senator Magnuson carried the bill, and Representative Hamilton. We asked for 3 things. A liquor license dropped to about $500, sell 3 bottles and samples. Then we got the liquor license dropped to about $1,500. Last year, Representative Franson with the Panther Distillery brought in 3 bills. They were kind of loosely drafted. We came in and said, how about 3 bottles and 3 45-milliliter samples? And the committee went along with the 3 samples at 45 milliliters. I think the progress in this area has been incremental, and I think that's a good idea. The bill as currently drafted, I think, is loosely drafted and is probably a bridge too far at this point, and I think we're going to hear that from the distributors in a second. The thing I'm handing out here, I think that if we're going to keep the 3-tier system in check, you've got to give a chance to the municipal liquor stores and the private liquor stores to be able to sell. There probably should be a cap of 3 750-milliliter bottles per person per day. That's a lot of liquor over a month, but under the current bill, you can walk in and take 40 cases if you want. That's really not fair to the retailers. So I think that needs to be tightened up. I do think that small distilleries have to be able to distribute their product, and I would urge you to let them distribute it in wholesale lots to anybody who's got a license to sell it, retailers and wholesalers. Otherwise, the distributors want big lots, they don't want small lots, and they don't want to go to small places, so you've got to let them sell their stuff, but within the three-tier system. So anybody who's a liquor store or a wholesaler, let them sell to them. They should be able to sell bulk products to each other, to farm wineries, breweries, and large distilleries, $30,000 people. And they should be able to buy, because as the industry matures, they're going to be making cordials and things that they cannot produce. So they're going to need to rectify, they're going to need certain products, and they have to be able to buy those products from somebody else. They currently can't do that. So, for instance, Montana currently is looking at letting them buy, letting their distillers buy that. We need something like that. I think while you're working on the bill, instead of coming back every year, let them sell to people out of state according to federal law. That's a very small area right now, but as it expands, as they move the winery up from 50 to 250 at the federal level, the state will track that. You don't have to keep coming back. And I think the last thing is, for all these things, don't make them buy another license, a distributor license, a bulk license. Just say a license under the micro distillery lets you do some of the things are all in that I proposed. So there's a single license fee at $1,500, and the industry will flourish. We've been pushing this. It's been a very lonely battle. Usually only myself testifies, and Nick Smith, who's with the grape-growing part of the university. Just one little thing. We were at the Surly bill 3 years ago. There were 300 people for the Surly bill. Our bill was so small and insignificant, they put us on first. Nick testified, I testified, and the gentleman who had the first farm winery license in 1976 testified. So it's come a long way. There's probably about 25 micro distilleries operational in the planning stages or building. So if you do these things, you'll have a flourishing micro distillery industry probably within 3 years, and that'll be good for taxes, for jobs, for farmers, and for the distilleries themselves. So if you could look at some of the ideas I've given you, I think that you'd have a good bill, and I think everyone could get around it. Thank you,
Mr. Pletzer. And yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, interesting to look through. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli with McGrant Shea Law Firm on behalf of Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association and Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association. I told the testifier, I said, you got to be careful. You might want to get those before we end here. They'll walk away. I just wanted to testify briefly on this bill. We've had a number of excellent conversations with a number of the people that you saw testify here today. And associations are frankly excited about the direction that this is going, and that the possibilities and the enthusiasm you saw. I would say, when people talk about we're going to take money out of the retailers and the wholesalers, I think we can all lift the boats together here and all do better. And we all do better. So hopefully we can find a way to do that. I think that as we go forward, there's a number of provisions in this bill that we like and that we can work with. I think there's a couple of little tweaks that we can make here and there and that we can get to yes. I've said everywhere we're excited about this movement. We were excited about the craft beer movement. And we want to do it right. We don't want to do it in a way that harms one group of people operating in the area versus another. And so hopefully we'll be able to do that. We've been able to do that up to now. So thank you for your time. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to House File 2200? Representative Hoppe, any final words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. And I look forward to meeting with everybody and working on these things.
All right. Then with that, House File 2200 is laid over for possible inclusion in the House Omnibus Liquor Bill. Finally, we're going to finish our discussion of liquor by talking about sacramental wine. House File 1965, the chair will move that House File 1965 be laid over for possible inclusion of liquor omnibus bill. Representative Lean, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I will be as brief here as the committee would like. So.
Hi.
House file 1965 pertains to Sacramento wine, and I would like to get an author's amendment, plead all author's amendment before the committee.
The DE1 is offered by the chair. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Lee, to your bill.
And the purpose of the delete all amendment was based on my conversations with the Department of Public Safety to get this bill as manageable as possible. Basically, this law had been in statute until the mid-90s. It was repealed. From what I understand, it was repealed because there just wasn't the demand for religious bookstores to sell Sacramento wine. Folks thought it was a little obsolete. However, also based on my conversations with Department of Public Safety, it's been agreed upon if there are bookstores that would like to do this. You know, this is certainly something they're open to reinstating. So I will certainly stand for any questions.
Are there questions for Representative Lean or anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to House File 1965, I'm sorry. Yes, sir. If you just want to come on down and identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is August Berkshire, and I'm the legislative chair for the newly formed Secular Coalition for Minnesota. And I wanted to bring up 3 points in regard to this. First, we wonder why it's necessary. Why can't people just go buy their wine from a liquor store like anyone else could? Perhaps they could negotiate for quantity discounts if they need to buy a lot of wine. Second, this is an issue of religious privilege, giving certain religious people rights that nobody else has, and certain religious bookstores rights that a regular bookstore wouldn't have. And this puts the state in an awkward position of trying to determine what is and is not a legitimate religious sacrament. Some of you may know about the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. This bill allows for ceremonies in their home, so who's to say this wouldn't include a drunken spaghetti party? So, in conclusion, we think that any changes to liquor law should apply to all Minnesotans equally. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berkshire. Is there anyone else who desires to be heard? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli on behalf of MMBA. First, I just want to apologize to the author. I haven't had a chance to talk with him I think it's Jason Atkins from the Catholic. Well, the people who are sponsoring it. As a general matter, understand the desire and the way it was discussed as religious bookstores. However, the way the bill's drafted doesn't just apply to religious bookstores. It says the commissioner may issue a license. That could be to anyone, any kind of store, any kind of thing, anybody who wanted a license, any person. It doesn't even have to be a store. It just says the commissioner may issue a license.
So Mr. Berkshire should actually like this then, since it does not. You just don't like it, but Mr. Berkshire now will.
you have to actually acknowledge. I don't know if he would acknowledge that he's a religion, but you have to acknowledge that you're a religion or a member of a religion.
Point taken.
So, in any case, further on it says that this applies. It starts off with rabbi, priest, minister, or established religion, or individual members of a religious organization, which basically, I think with the exception of Mr. Berkshire and folks that don't identify with any particular religion, it applies to a large group of people who identify with religion. So it basically allows anybody to get a license to sell to anybody, whoever they are. So I think we may even have some ordained ministers in the room. The Universal Life Church, I think, is a church that some folks may be aware of. Committee Administrator Kwapik. And so this would allow, folks that have, basically it allows any organization to import. It's not just sell it, import it and sell it. To anybody. So, finally, I understand the purpose of what you're trying to do, and I'm not necessarily in disagreement with that, but that isn't what this bill does. It's much broader than that. Finally, as a general matter, and I'm saying this somewhat softly, but as a general matter, we like to see everybody who sells the product pay dram shop. We all pay dram shop, and this exempts them from dram shop. This doesn't have any alcohol content on it, so there's a concern that if you've got a bill that would allow any sort of person to get a license to sell it to anybody they want, that this opens the door and they don't have to have dram shop for a situation we might not necessarily want. So,
thank you. We've got a couple questions, and we're going to give Representative Lean the final word. Representative Dean is asking. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually for Mr. Bagnoli or Representative Lean, if you could. I mean, I know we did have a chance to speak about this beforehand, and it was my understanding that this language used to be on the books, and we're bringing it back. And I think it was, I don't remember exactly what you told me, maybe 1996, something like that, we struck this. Why, if you don't know, maybe Mr. Bagnoli would know, why was this originally taken out of statute?
Well, and we do have Mr. McCormick here, who's been writing liquor laws in Minnesota since statehood. 1858, he wrote the very first one. If I Well, we just want to acknowledge your presence, Mr. McCormick, and we do appreciate it. Gentlemen, who wants to take it? Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sanders. Again, based on my conversations with House Research and the Department of Public Safety, there was just such few demand for these types of permits, and so folks at the time thought, you know, it was a pretty obsolete law, so it was taken off the books for that reason. However, again, based on my conversations with those parties, you know, neither party, well, Department of Public Safety, first and foremost, had said, you know, if this is something that these bookstores would like to do again, you know, they're not going to get in the way of that, so as long as the language is right for the bill. And I would like to say also that I do have a commitment with the Department of Public Safety. I understand this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion to put some tighter restrictions on, you know, what constitutes a religious bookstore or bona fide religious book and supply store. So these conversations are ongoing, and I do appreciate the opportunity to present the bill today.
And thank you, Representative Lean. Unless there's anything further, with that, House File, I've lost the number, 1965, is laid over for possible inclusion. Members, thank you for your extra 40 minutes tonight. We are now officially canceled for tomorrow. Watch your agendas or watch your emails for next week's agenda, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you all very much. With that, we stand adjourned.